You're listening to Straight Shooters, a straightforward golf podcast that'll straighten out your game. And here are your hosts, Keith Bennett and Henry Stettina.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to the Straight Shooters podcast. Really cool guest here today, Mark Wadagnoli. He is a professor of neuroscience at the University of Las Vegas. And he is the author of the book, Practice to Learn, Play to Win. And just really excited for this conversation. Henry and I have been talking about a long time for having him on the podcast and just talking about all things practice and all things improvement, how you can get the most out of your precious time. Mark, thanks for joining, and we're looking forward to this conversation.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so you know, for those of you, for the listeners who maybe don't know about you yet or are dying to learn, kind of how did you get into neuroscience? How did you get into the golf world? And then what was kind of how did the book Practice to Learn, Play to Win kind of come about? Where was that born from?
Yeah, Keith, I'm laughing because I don't know that there's anybody dying to learn about me, but I'm happy to share a little bit. So, yeah, I mean, the neuroscience, cognitive science area is sort of a windy road. I mean, most of them are, I think, to get to wherever we go. And essentially, you know, I've always been interested. I grew up as an athlete myself. I was always interested in how to get better at whatever it is that I was doing and helping other people get better as well. So I guess that's kind of where that came from. I was fortunate at Auburn University. They had a PhD area where you could study both cognitive psychology and human performance. So put together the mind and body both at the same time. And it was a really cool experience. So went from there, which was pretty theoretical, kind of hardcore science, to when I moved to UNLV, I was fortunate enough to be able to start my own lab and research project. And that's where we may talk about it a little bit, but a thing called the Challenge Point Framework was published with Tim Lee, who's an avid golfer, one of the most wonderful people in the world, by the way, as well. And it actually became a universal theory of learning. And I say that because there's been, you know, now probably 200 studies that have run testing the Challenge Point Framework from a variety of people. So not from necessarily from Tim and me, but, and it's so many different areas, people with, you know, Parkinson's disease, older adults, younger adults, children, athletes, on and on and on, just, you know, pick it. And over and over and over again, what you see is if you learn a certain way, if you practice a certain way, you'll learn 3 or 4 times faster than normal. And you'll be stress resistant, which means that under stressful situations like competition or tests or whatever, you're more likely to perform well. At the time that we developed the theory, it was based on behavioral data, which meant here we put them under this situation, here's how they behave. Since then, we've come to find out that there's a real neuroscience and biochemistry that's behind it as well, which is super cool. And then now it's evolved into flow states and a whole host of other things. But anyway, that area really sort of drove me into the application piece as well. And this coincidentally was about the time that the golf coach, UNLV's golf coach, Dwayne Knight, had asked if I would work with the golf team. I'll tell you that story later if you're interested, but I didn't play golf at the time. But he asked me if I'd work with the golf team, and I did. And there were some really great players at the time that I got to work with, most notably Ryan Moore, who about a year and a half after I started working with him and the team, Ryan had, you know, maybe the greatest amateur season ever, winning everything, NCAA, Sahali Players. I was telling somebody the other day, he lost. One of the first events I remember him losing, quote unquote, was he finished 13th at the Masters, right? As an amateur.
Yeah.
So that was his worst finish But
tough loss.
Yeah, I mean it was crazy. He won the World Amateur, the NCAA Championships, the Holly Players Championship, U.S. Amateur, U.S. Pub Links. I mean, it was crazy. It was crazy, and I was really, really fortunate to get to work with him through all of that and spend a lot of time with him. And during that time, I would put together notes, and we would have lunch. We'd talk about some of these notes and things that I'd written for him to, you know, to talk about whatever the science was behind the way we were practicing and the way we were thinking about things and so forth. And Ryan was super good about giving some examples as well. And that evolved into a book. And it was really something that came out of, you know, just a labor of love, and very much enjoyed working with Ryan as well. And then the second edition was something that, you know, there were some holes in the first one and I didn't think it was particularly well written. And so the second edition, then a friend, Chris Bertram, and I have actually done a third edition that is significantly different because the science has updated. Haven't published that yet, but we've drafted that entire book, and we need to dust that off and send it out pretty soon. So that really, that's how it happened. And so again, sort of a windy road all the way along.
Amazing. Yeah. I can't wait to get my hands on that third edition there. Talk about the ultimate case study. I mean, working closely with, you know, a very talented group of golfers, and then you've got a guy like Ryan Moore, who's driven, who's motivated, and you're driven and motivated to learn about this stuff. It sounds like just kind of like two forces coming together. I'm curious to know what it was like working with somebody, a player like that, and what his mental state was as he's clicking off all of these things. Like you said, literally winning every tournament he plays. Like, from your perspective watching him, was there just something that you saw that you hadn't seen from other players as far as a dedication to what you guys were working on? Was it like, what was it like kind of working close to somebody who was just reeling wins in golf, which is, you know, unheard of?
Well, you know, first of all, he's incredibly talented. And creative. You know, physically, he's very gifted. His eye-hand coordination is off the charts. He's gifted, and it was his golf swing, right, which was really important. If he was sort of playing with a golf swing that had been given to him, when things were a little bit wonky, he wouldn't know how to get it back. But it was his golf swing. So, but the mental state, I think, was probably more impressive than anything. You know, I remember him telling me, I was just telling the story the other day to somebody, and he said, you know, he had a very good freshman year, but it wasn't otherworldly like it was, you know, became a sophomore, junior, senior year. And it really was a mind shift that made the difference. And because he always had the talent. Ryan has always been a very good practicer. And most collegians, in fact, most professionals aren't very good. They're hard workers. They're you know, all the ones who are sort of at the upper levels are hard workers, but very few of them are efficient workers. And Ryan always had a purpose for what he was doing. And so he didn't need to go out and bang hundreds of balls because he had a very specific purpose for what he was doing. So some of that naturally fit into the challenge point framework, which made it really easy. And he was willing to do whatever he needed to do to get better. And it's interesting, you know, the best players, for that matter, the best performers, you know, I work with athletes, of course, but also with corporate executives, with trauma surgeons, with a whole hosts of different elite level performers, and they have a couple things in common. They're stubborn, but they're not stubborn so much that they won't listen. And when they, so they will listen. And that combination of being able to listen and being stubborn, so they'll listen, they'll take something on as their own, and then they'll own it, right? And then they run with it. And Ryan was as good as anybody at doing that. And so that combination, I think, was one of the many things. We've seen some other people, you know, who have done those kinds of things. One of the players that's come out recently, who's an absolute joy to work with, is a guy named Garrick Higo, who's he's done really well in all the tours he's played. And incredibly nice guy, but he's the same way. He's very focused on what he's doing. He'll do whatever it takes to get better. And he's got a great attitude about it. Everything to him becomes an opportunity to get better and to learn. And that's really a difference maker right there.
Yeah, that's what you just said there about hard work versus practice. I think, you know, Henry and I both, you know, tried to play professional golf kind of out of school and have seen others, you know, try to get better. And I think looking back on my own experience, I thought hard work was practice. You know, how many balls can I hit? How many seven irons in a row or eight irons or drivers can I hit? And I, now that I've kind of removed myself from that and have time to kind of look at it from the outside perspective, it's quite obvious that I wasn't practicing. You know, I kind of thought of practicing as like, oh, Vijay Singh is a practicer. That guy's a practicer, right? But when you have limited time to practice, I think you start to really get down to what is important when you don't have as much time to do it, when you've got a job and stuff, and you almost get better at your craft of practicing. It's kind of sounds silly, but it's almost like practicing how to practice, like figuring out how to practice. You know, what would be like a great first step for somebody who's got a couple hours a week, but they just don't even know where to start? Yeah. Cause it can seem overwhelming. You know, what would be a great step? Is it kind of keeping stats on your game? Is it, you know, what's a great place to start for that person?
You know, so I'll tell you real quick. I think practice is a little bit like cooking and sex. And what I mean by that is everybody thinks they're good at it. Very few people are.
And, I like that.
because you just, you know, everybody can do it, right? It doesn't mean that you're good at it because you can do it. And just because you work harder at it doesn't mean it's going to be any better. And right. So there is definitely a way to do it right and a way to do it less efficiently. So I would say there's a couple things. One is if it's easy, it's not the right practice, right? So one of the things about challenge point, without going in too much depth, is there is an optimal point at which you're challenged, optimal for learning. Right. And that's what we care about, right? As guys who were aspiring tour players, you know that it's really about it's how you play is actually about how you've practiced. But most people don't think about it from that perspective. And so ultimately, if you're practicing the things that you already know, what's the point, right?
Right.
What you need to do is sharpen the blade of those other areas that you don't know. You just pound that steel, right? It's not that you disregard the things you're good at, but it's you ratchet up the challenge. So for the most part, as a really super simple way of thinking about it, if you're 80, 90% successful on shots that you're hitting, for example, or putts that you're making or whatever, it's too easy for you. If you're down around 60%, maybe, now you're challenging yourself. But let me tell you what that means to be successful, okay? So let's say, for example, that you're hitting a club to a pin that's 160 yards away, right? Okay. If you can hit that green 80% of the time from 160 yards away, that's too easy of a challenge. So what I'm not saying is start missing the green. What I'm saying is now try to hit the left side of the green, not the whole green. And so your misses may still be on the green, but it's on the left side of the green. Or you have to start the ball on the right side of the pin and end it at the pin to be successful, right? So you can change the challenge and still be what would look to be successful, right? but your level of success changes. Your window of what is a successful attempt narrows as you get better and better and better. Now, I say that to players like you guys. To other players who are just starting the game, success may be actually just making contact with the ball, right? Or getting the ball up in the air or whatever it happens to be. But the point is, if you're successful 80 or 90% of the time, it feels really good, but you're not optimizing your opportunity to learn, right? And every single ball that you hit should be an opportunity to learn. So I'll give you an example. If I ask you the same math problem over and over and over again, you'll figure it out the first time. Like if I say, what's 54 plus 97, it'll take you a little while to figure it out. Then if I ask you, what's 54 plus 97, you'll go, that's the same one that I just had. And you'll, and then eventually, as I ask you the third, fourth, fifth time, you'll just tell me the answer. You're not going back and figuring out the answer again, right? When you sit there and hit a seven iron over and over and over again, you're essentially doing the same math problem over and over again, right? Success is good. You're fast. You're, you know, all these things. It feels good, but you're not learning the rules of the game. You're just reproducing something, but then you go out to the course and you've got a seven iron that you're hitting over water. And that's a completely different ballgame. I mean, you're like, well, I don't understand. I hit seven irons great on the range. So why can't I do this? And the reason is because you haven't learned to do that, right? So I'll just tell you one more quick thing about this and then I'll stop talking for a second. With all the guys that I work with, and this is, I'll use golf as the example, but it's all the people that I work with. There's a performance formula that we use. And the formula is ability minus interference equals performance. So if you have the ability to go shoot a 67, but you shoot a 77, that's not because you're incapable. It's because interference has caused these additional strokes. What most people do is they go after the round and they hit drivers or whatever, right? Thinking that it's the ability that's the issue, but it's not, it's the interference. And so if you can figure out how to work on interference and ability at the same time during practice, now, all of a sudden, you've increased your ability and you've decreased your interference and you get closer to optimizing your potential. So challenge point really is about how you do that. And some of it is challenging yourself at an appropriate level during practice.
Yeah, you know, I heard something recently where Steph Curry said that, like, he shoots three-pointers and it doesn't count unless it's a swoosh now.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's taking, he's to the point where it's like hitting, just making a three-pointer isn't good enough anymore. And that's kind of like what you said of just hitting to a green and hitting it over and over and over and thinking you're getting better. But that's not challenging you enough, or, you know, for someone of that caliber, it's not even coming close to challenging him enough. So they've changed they've changed what is successful or what is a success, kind of like what you were talking about there. You got to hit the right side of the green or hit the left side of the green. Now, how do you approach that from somebody who's, let's say, like just learning to hit somebody who just wants to learn to hit a draw, like that's it, you know, like versus somebody who can hit all nine ball flights? You know, I think you said in your book, like removing variables. I'm super curious about that. What, you know, as far as how many variables you can take on, you know, like what's the optimal amount per skill level?
So this is a great question. I do want to just quick comment about Steph Curry. And one of the nuances to that is he's not only essentially decreasing the acceptable error rate, right? By going from anything that's in to has to be a swish. That naturally puts additional pressure on him, right? Because it's harder. And so he's training interference as well. And we do the same thing when you have to hit the left side of the green instead of, you know, the whole green. It's not just about the physical act of hitting the green. It's the pressure that you put on yourself during practice that then translates more naturally to what happens during competition. So, but to answer your question, you know, I think the idea behind how you set up practice. One of the reasons why the challenge point is a universal theory is because it doesn't matter who the person is, it adjusts to that individual. And that's really unique. And what it says is that learning is not a one size fits all. It's not like I can say, okay, guys, here's how you should go practice and here's how everybody should practice, because that's just not true. You know, if we're talking about hitting the left side of the green from, you know, 160 yards away, when some people can't hit the ball 160 yards. So it'd be ridiculous to ask them to hit the left side of the green, right? So the point that you're saying is to remove variables. A brand new player, or even you know, an 18 handicap, for example, you know, which is a pretty good golfer, they can go out and play, they can enjoy the game and so forth. That person is going to have some inherent variability in what they do, right? They're not going to be a tour pro who can just hit the same shot over and over again. And so because they have inherent variability, you shouldn't load up a lot of variability on top of that. You shouldn't change targets every time or change clubs every time or try to hit, as you said, all nine windows. You know, you should have some degree of consistency, especially when you're learning something new, because there's inherent variability in it. You take a reasonable player and ask that person to hit five draws in a row, you know, five-yard draws in a row, they're not going to do it. Okay. They may hit two just like they want, two that are kind of in the ballpark and one that has nothing to do with it, right? So until you've decreased that variability, it doesn't make sense to throw more stuff on top. So in that particular case, for example, I would lay down a yardage stick, you know, to give direction. So you know that you're aimed at the right target. So that variable is gone. Maybe even put something across stick so you know the ball position. So that variable is gone. Keep the same club. So that variable is gone, right? And so you take away those variables because all you're trying to do is hit that one shot. Now, if you get to the point where you can hit that shot 60, maybe even 70% of the time, now add a variable in, okay? Change the club, for example. You've been hitting a 9-iron, now you're going to hit a 7-iron, okay? And so as you get above that 65, 70% success rate, add in more and more variability. And that increased variability is going to increase challenge. And as we go back to the math problem, it's going to change the math problem slightly. So you have to figure out the answer again. Okay. But that really depends on the individual. Some people may be weeks with a club that they're trying to hit that draw, and somebody may be four or five shots and they can do it, right? So to tell them both to do the same thing doesn't make any sense. So I will say this, though, really, really super important. We always give two rules of practice. If you do nothing else but these two rules, it's going to help your practice. And even the most experienced players have this rule. So everybody from beginning to end. And rule number one is three balls. Never hit more than three balls in a row. And rule number two is watch the ball down. So you watch the ball until it hits the ground, or in the case of a driver, until you can't see it anymore. Those two rules become incredibly important. Sound really simple, but there's so much science behind it. And if you watch most people, they rarely watch the ball till it hits the ground, especially if it's a bad shot.
Yeah, the quick rakers in the putting, right? It's 3 feet off and they rake it back. They don't even watch it. I mean, like, how far is that ball going to roll by? How do you know how big of a stroke to make on your next putt?
Right.
You know,
and you know, your brain and your body needs to process the kinesthetics, right? The senses of what just happened to be able to change and learn. So, yeah, I mean, there's so many things, but I agree with you. I can't tell you how many times I've seen somebody hit, and it's almost like the next response is to reach out and rake it back.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Henry, what do you got for Mark? I've been too excited to ask him questions. So I haven't let you speak yet.
No worries. Yeah, Mark. So I'm curious to know how your practice structures change based on the skill level. You mentioned a little bit about that 18 handicapper needing to play the same shot and as well as eliminating some of the variables. I take it you work with the UNLV golf team. What does it look like for a freshman to arrive on campus and how that player might transition during their 4 years with the team in preparations for maybe playing professionally?
So this is such a great question. I'll tell you a story. Every single freshman, the very first time I work with them, we do the exact same thing. And I say, okay, guys, here's buckets, balls. You guys practice, just do what you normally do. And then we'll work from that. Right. And there were two guys that we had, both of them have graduated. One's Shintaro Bon and the other is John Oda. They came in same year, both very talented, both really great guys, very hard workers, both of them. And Shin did what every other player does. He knocked the bucket over and started hitting golf balls. And Johnny grabbed three golf balls and set them down and hit those three, cleaned his club, grabbed three more and hit the, and I had never seen a freshman do this ever. And so I said, Johnny, this is crazy. Like I've never seen a freshman do this. And he goes, I read your book. And because what happened is, here's the thing, that, and it was hilarious. In fact, it's funny. I saw him probably a month ago or so. We just had a conversation about that. It was so funny, you know, because it's still to this day, I remember where we were, what was going on, because it just struck me so much how everybody would, you know, that's what they do. They just dump a bucket. And here's why. At some point in your golf career, early in your golf career, you have to hit a lot of balls, no doubt about it, right? I don't care who you are, you have to hit a lot of balls. And so you get better by practicing a lot. But to get to the next level, you have to do something different. Hitting a lot of balls will get you up to a level, but hitting a lot of balls will keep you from getting the next level. So you can't just keep banging your head against the wall. You have to move over and do something different. And Johnny had already figured that out, how to do something different. Now, Shin, you look at their freshman years, Johnny had a great freshman year and Shin, very talented, but really struggled. They eventually got to be, you know, pretty comparable players, but Shin also changed how he practiced dramatically. And because he learned that he needed to learn how to practice. And so one of the big things about freshmen, those two rules that I told you, the three ball and the watch it down, that's the very first rule that we talk about, very first two rules that we talk about with everybody, regardless. And then we build on that. And the idea of creating challenge during practice, the idea of ability minus interference equals performance, and how you take apart your game and you say, okay, I lost five strokes today. How did I lose those five strokes? Is it because I don't have the ability to hit the shots I was trying to hit, or it's because I got nervous or I lost my attention or whatever. And that's where we'll work. And so that's really where it comes from. But you know, really, I got to tell you, Henry, this isn't golf related, but a lot of what we do is talk about the ability piece, the interference piece with the freshmen, because they're in a new environment. A lot of our players are international. They're in a new country, a new environment. They're in college. They're on their own. They're these kinds of, there's a lot of interference going on that affects them off the course that comes onto the course with them. And so a lot of what we do early on is really talk to them about how to decrease their interference. And then we talk about how to improve their practice.
Yeah, that's interesting that, you know, ability minus interference equals performance. I think ability and performance are pretty well discussed, but the interference piece is the new one. Mm-hmm. And you know, we oftentimes look at a typical practice session where a person's playing from flat lies on the driving range, making sure that the ball's sitting up nicely on the grass, and they're hitting to the same target over and over. But that doesn't yet necessarily reflect the way the game of golf is actually played. And so I'm curious to hear a little bit more how you might simulate that through the interference piece, maybe on course, or even the mental challenges. You know, practicing mentally can be a new way of practicing for most players.
Well, so it's interesting because this gets to your other question as well. It's very different if it's a new player versus somebody I've worked with for a while. So I'll give you the example of two different players, both of which are just phenomenal ball strikers. One's a freshman, one's a senior right now. And this just happened, I don't know, a few weeks ago. So the three ball, we also have a routine that we do, and it's tempo practice test. And so they'll start off with tempo, just hitting tempo shots before they do anything. And then there's rounds of practice, and it'll be, again, I'll use the 160 yard shot, right? So they're practicing that shot. They're practicing knowing that they're going to have a test on that. Now, here's something that's interesting about that. This is going to be a super obvious study, but, and it has nothing to do with golf, but you can bring it back to golf. Two groups of students, regular classroom, these are college students. And what they did was they told the two groups, we're going to give you this lecture. And then one of the groups, they said, by the way, this lecture is being recorded, so afterwards you can watch it if you want. And the other one, they didn't tell them that. That's it. That's the only difference between the two. And they gave them the same lecture. Afterwards, as a surprise, they gave them a test. And the group, they heard the same lecture, same person, everything was the same, except for that little caveat that said, by the way, this is going to be taped. Afterwards, the group that was not told that it was taped did significantly better than the other group, right? So the presentation of information was exactly the same, but they did different on the test. And the reason is they were listening differently. They were listening differently because one group knew this was their one chance, and the other group knew they could pick up the information anytime they wanted. Okay, so how that relates to this is, if I tell you we're going to practice this and then we're going to test it, you're going to pay attention differently than if we're just practicing. So part of it, part of the trick is letting people know up front that they're going to be tested. Okay, so they're going to be tested, and we go through the practice, and then we do a test. And the test can be something really simple. The test, for example, with this freshman was, you're going to hit three balls to that target. And I'll use the 160 as an example, to that target. Okay. And this was, again, a really good ball striker. You have to hit the left side of the green. So this guy, on almost all of his practice shots, did exactly that. I mean, he's a good ball striker. On the tests, 1 out of 3. Okay, so the thing is, he had the ability to hit a small target. But once he got tested, which was simply, okay, now it's the test. That's it. It's not like we put something else on the line. We just said, okay, now it's the test. Hit three more balls to that same place, 1 out of 3. He blew one probably 20 yards left of the green. One was a few yards right, and he hit one on the left side of the green. So what does he need to work on? Not ball striking, interference. Okay. So in that's one way. In another way, with the senior, that test that we did with the freshman is not a test for him, because he's been through this for 4 years. So he can hit the left side, whether it's practice or test, no problem. In his case, we need to simulate anxiety and arousal states from a physiological perspective. So he does exercise before he's going to hit a shot.
and he has to get his heart rate down, has to get his focus back. He has to be able to do this. Now, there's techniques that we use like breath walking and some other things to be able to do that. He has that available to him. But the point is, the what is a test for the freshman and what is a test for the senior? And it's not just their ages, right? It's their skill level and what they're working on and so forth. They're different depending on the individual. So this is back to the challenge point. It scales to the person. And that's one of the real, you know, sort of magic dust around, you know, secret sauce around challenge point.
That's interesting. I had heard about challenge point back a few years ago at the PGA Teaching and Coaching Summit when it was introduced there. And, you know, ever since I've been thinking a lot about it, and Keith and I have sometimes referred to the fitness industry and how even a pretty novice person getting into fitness might set up some kind of a schedule, a weekly schedule where they're going to work Monday, Wednesday, Friday. They're going to do X number of exercises with certain sets and reps. And it always seems to be relatively structured. But yet in the golf world, we don't seem to see many players having some kind of a practice schedule. And I'm curious to know what a player might want to do in terms of developing a practice schedule and how much time maybe you would be putting into it as their coach for designing one.
Well, so, you know, it's interesting. We just went over our break goals with the UNLV team. And one of the freshmen said that his goal is never to go to the golf course without a practice plan. And it's a huge, huge advantage. You know, we talked about the two rules of practice before, but the practice plan is, you know, arguably one of the most neglected areas of all practice, because most people go and they equate the number of balls they hit with the quality of practice they have. And that's not true at all. Most of the guys that I work with, and again, this is, you know, these are even pros. Most of the guys I work with, we'll hit, you know, maybe 35 balls, and they're mentally exhausted by the end of it because of how they practice. And so the practice plan becomes incredibly important. You know, some really simple things like you have to know what your goal is. You know, why are you practicing today? What do you want to accomplish? And how do you know if you've accomplished it? That sounds so simple. And yet you ask most people, like if you were just to walk along a driving range and say, what's your goal today in practice? People would make up something, but it would be something like, oh, I want to get better, or I don't want to duff this shot anymore, or I want to be able to get it off the ground, or, you know, something. It would be those kinds of things. That's not really a goal. That's sort of a wish, right? A goal would be something more like, you know, I want to be able to hit my 8-iron 155 7 out of 10 times, right? And I want to be able to decrease my shot dispersion. Something that's measurable, and at the end you know that you did it or you didn't. So somebody may also say, a better player may say, well, I want to make sure that I'm in this position at the top of my swing. That's actually not a goal per se. That's a technique, okay? Unless, and these two can conflate to some extent, unless you've got somebody there or a video that's actually measuring that, right? So goals have to be something that you measure, or they're just wishes. And so setting up the practice plan becomes really important. Here's, this is my goal. Here's how I know if I've accomplished it. And these are the things that I need to do to accomplish that goal. Like, this is the practice I need to do. And again, it's all in this tempo, practice, test, recycle, right? So when you get done with that test, the thing that you go back to is tempo. No matter how you did on your test, you go back to tempo, and maybe you need more practice, or maybe you don't, and maybe you need an additional test, or maybe you don't, but it's tempo is bookending practice. Okay, so anyway, the answer to your question is what's your goal? How do you know when you've accomplished it? And what are the specific things that you need to do to get there? How many practice attempts do you need? How many tests do you need? What is the test going to be? You know, these kinds of things, they all become really important. Now, most people, when they go practice, it's not a single goal. They may have a goal with their full swing. They may have a goal with short game. They may have, but it's the same thing with all of them, right? Most sort of high-end players are going to have a goal in different areas of their game. And so it doesn't have to be super complicated at all. I mean, it could be something where for each of those areas, you're taking less than 5 minutes to be able to put together the goal, plan, and action for what you're trying to do. But then you go out with a purpose, and then every single shot you hit should have a purpose. And the practice plan, you know, is exactly, Henry, what you're saying is key to that, key to being able to do that.
Yeah, it seems like this is coming at a really good time for me. You know, in fitness, it makes so much sense to be able to measure on a weekly basis, go stand on the scale and figure out the BMI for the week and see if there was any improvement. And in golf, we can become very lackadaisical as to measuring our progress over time. And, you know, for one reason, some people might not have technology to measure it, but it can certainly be as simple as number of putts hold or number of greens in regulation or how many times am I hitting the green from this specific distance. So there's certainly some simpler ways of going about it that we're just maybe overlooking and can be changed.
Well, yeah, excuse me, Keith, but Henry, but I will say to your point, if you're a tournament player, you have those statistics, right? The only question that I would ask about those statistics, are they driven by ability or are they driven by interference? Mm-hmm. Right. So if you, for example, if you hit, I don't know, two fairways, then it would seem like you can't drive the ball very well. But if you then go to the driving range and you're striping it, that's not an ability issue. That's an interference issue. But the first clue is that you're missing fairways. Now, why are you missing fairways? And then what do you need to work on? And that becomes really important. Tournament players. Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead, please.
I was going to say, I'm definitely guilty of that, right? You have a terrible driving round. You go and just pound balls at the range. You hit them all good. And you go, where was that on the golf course? Right? But I missed the key component there, which was the interference piece, because I'd never even, like, again, you don't consider it. Like Henry said, we've outlined ability, we've outlined performance, but we're missing the interference part. And, you know, kind of something you said a little earlier about that study where the same lecture, one was told there was, you know, they're going to have a recorded version of it to go back to, and the other was they didn't get that. You know, for me, it's kind of like, you know, I'll film some of my lessons and kind of give that to the student as like a package at the end. Now that I'm kind of thinking about it, I might be shortchanging them of an opportunity to like actually listen and to say, hey, write down on notes for me what we talked about today. And that kind of just struck me just now. So that was kind of cool. And then, man, I was laughing internally at the rules of practice. I don't think I've ever seen anybody conform to the rules of practice and hitting three balls at a time and taking a break. You know, you hear those stories of like Ben Hogan hitting balls, but then he'd like stop to take a smoke break. He'd smoke a cigarette. He'd jot down some notes in a little pad, and then he'd get back to kind of what he was doing. You don't really hear those stories disseminated as much as like, you know, oh, his swing technique was perfect, but like, why was it perfect? Well, because he knew what the heck to do when he was on the range. He would stop. He would take a time to kind of let it sink in. And that can be said for giving lessons too, like just giving your student five balls and taking a bucket, putting it to where he can't even, or she can't even reach for it. And you can like learning to kind of structure it all. So you almost kind of help them fall into better practicing. But yeah, that's, man, you just hit on a lot of points there for me, for sure. I could go on for days.
Well, you know, it's funny. Hogan's a great example of that. really purposeful practice. I heard this story that he would have his caddy go out, a certain distance away with a baseball glove and catch wedges, right? Mm. That's very purposeful practice because they had to shag their own balls back then. And so every ball really did have a purpose. And so the combination of these kinds of things about having a specific purpose, a specific target, you knew right away whether it was successful or not, and then taking breaks, these things, become, he knew it before any of us knew the science. I'll tell you, there's an effect called consolidation with memory. And essentially what it says is, if you think about memory like Jell-O, right? When you very first pour the Jell-O in, it's liquid, and over time it consolidates. And memories are that way. They take time. A lot of these studies are overnight studies and so forth. But the thing is, even if a matter of seconds, 20, 30 seconds between shots can help consolidate that information. But you think about, I think maybe this was mentioned in the second edition of the book. It's a true story where I watched this guy hit golf balls and I was so amazed at how he was doing it. He had an average of about 6 seconds between shots, and he hit an entire bucket this way. And I thought, this poor dude thinks he's working his ass off. And he is, but he's learning almost nothing, because he isn't giving his brain time to actually process the information. And it's not my place to go tell the guy, hey, dude, you're doing this in a really inefficient way. But because I know he wanted to get better, a lot of people do that. And Keith, you had said this earlier, especially if you hit a bad shot, we don't like that feeling. But there's a lot to be learned from that. But what we do is, as soon as we realize it's bad, we rake another one over and we're hitting that, right, to get the taste out of our mouth. That's a huge mistake from a learning perspective,
And is it the case that a person merely has to watch it come to rest and that their brain will diagnose that accordingly?
Yeah. And the better player you are, the more automatically you'll do this. So let me give you an example of this. I don't know if you ever watch like Olympic gymnastics or diving or those kinds of sports, right? I know very little about any of that. But if I'm watching with somebody who knows those sports, they'll pick up things that I would never see. I went to a Raiders game, a Las Vegas Raiders game yesterday. And one of the people there was talking about, well, why are they doing that? And where's the ball? And, these kinds of things, because they didn't know football. And when we get used to seeing certain things, like you guys see things in golf swings that novice players don't see, right? The better you are at it, the more automatically you can pick up what are called salient cues or really important aspects of what's happening. And so the better you are, the less time you need to pick those things up. Your brain will automatically do it. Like, I guarantee you that you hit a shot and you know right away, you pick up feelings and sounds and things that novice players won't pick up, right? So you don't need, a minute, 2 minutes to do it, but novice do. So, Keith, you're talking about the people you're giving lessons to. A novice player may need a few seconds. Like you say, what did you feel there? And they may have to think about it. But if you're talking with Henry, Henry's going to go, oh, here's what happened, and I did this, and here's why I did it, and so forth. But that processing becomes incredibly important. So you, as an experienced player, can generate your own feedback. As somebody who's a more novice player, a lot of times you need a coach or somebody to generate that feedback for you and then put that together with what the feeling was. And so even that has to scale to the individual.
Yeah. Just thinking about practice again, with technology and things that we have nowadays, you know, Henry and I both have access to TrackMan and, you know, stuff that tells you about the club face and the club path. You know, what are some things that you might do as exercises for somebody who's learning kind of, okay, could you tell how open the face was, or how, you know, which direction the path was moving there? Like, are there some things that you've, you know, with tech, as technologies come into the game, that you've been like, wow, this is really cool that we can do this now, and I can test your ability to recognize that?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. At one point it was video, and you know, now it's moved to TrackMan and those kinds of things. They're great, great tools. I love TrackMan, but just like any other tool, it can be abused, right? There are people who just they become so fixated on the TrackMan numbers that they forget what's creating that swing. So, you know, I said early on, Ryan Moore's swing is Ryan Moore's swing. And he knows so much about it. But there are some guys now who they're so fixated on the TrackMan numbers that they don't know what's creating those numbers necessarily. Now, that said, it still is a great tool. And so this gets back to another question that was asked, how do you remove variables? If what you're trying to teach somebody is to have, you know, a particular face angle or an approach angle, right? One of the things people don't know a lot is what their approach angle is. So if that's what you're trying to teach, then that's what you focus on. That one variable, let's take away all the other variables. Let's create this particular attack angle or this particular swing path or whatever it is that you want to create. And that's what we're going to work on. So in the book, you know, we talk about discovery, rediscovery as two of the types of practice, and refinement is the third, which most people, you know, trying to refine a skill. But discovery is really about discovering what helps you to get into a particular position or hit a ball a particular way, or in this case, what helps you with the attack angle or the swing plane or these kinds of things, right? So there's a method to teach violin called the Suzuki method. And what they do is they take little kids and they say, here's your violin, you know, put your finger on the strings and then move the bow back and forth. Make this sound, and they give him a sound, and the kid just plays around and eventually creates that sound. And then eventually they're able to play full songs by making sounds through experimentation. Okay. So if you say, okay, you need a steeper attack angle for this, then here's what I want you to do. Let's play around a little bit, and I'll tell you what your attack angle is. And you tell them, and then eventually you say, what do you think your attack angle was? Once they get enough knowledge base, right, to be able to do that. And then that TrackMan becomes the tool that you use instead of something that the person uses as a crutch. And then it can be incredibly valuable.
Wow, that violin method there really just hit me as a cool way to go about teaching. You know, with more of an external cue versus kind of the, you know, how do you place your fingers and when, you know, just make this sound. That's really cool. Mark, this is, well, you know, want to be conscious of your time and taking the time to talk with us, but this has been one of the more valuable hours I've definitely spent talking to somebody. I'm sure Henry feels the same. Henry, any last questions for Mark? And obviously, you know, ton to learn here.
Mark, I appreciate your time. Like Keith said, I think this was a very valuable hour spent. And I honestly think that we're just barely scratching the surface, that there's just so much to be unpacked when it comes to practice. I think this is an area of our game that's severely lacking. And I appreciate and applaud you for what you've been doing. And I'm looking forward to learning more about your research and your book.
Well, thanks, guys. Thanks for having me on. This has been a blast. I can't believe an hour has flown by already.
I know. Yeah, hopefully we can do this again at some point in the future. And I'll definitely be picking up the newest version of your book there and just kind of see what you've added to it, because this has definitely been something I've come back to multiple times here and have tons of notes written inside it. So it's been awesome. But hey, where can the listener find more information on your research, or where can they go to buy your book, or you know, listen to any or find more about what you've done?
Well, that's probably the hardest question you've asked me so far. The book is out of print right now. We pulled it off the shelf while we're working on the next edition. But from a research perspective, you know, Google Scholar has, I wouldn't go to the original Challenge Point paper, but there's some things written about Challenge Point in golf that might be interesting to people. And not just for me, from a lot of different people. So I would go to Google Scholar, Challenge Point and golf, Challenge Point Framework Golf, might be a good source. And then of course, shoot me an email if you're interested in mark.guadagnoli@unlv.edu. So.
Awesome. Very cool. Well, hey, we appreciate it so much. It was great to meet you, and hopefully our paths will cross in the future and we can dive into this stuff a little bit more.
Yeah. Thanks guys. Really appreciate it. Good luck with
everything. Thank you, Mark. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark.
Talk to you later.
Have a great day. Bye.